Now I'd like to introduce Jacques Rivard, who is going to introduce David Suzuki. I think many of you know Jacques. Jacques is a longtime environmental correspondent in Canada, working for the CBC, currently working for the CBC in Vancouver, and he is the first Canadian elected to the board of directors of SEJ. Thanks, Jacques.
No, I'll try Spanish now. Ahorita. Now, tonight, I will be introducing Mr. Suzuki, Dr. Suzuki, a little later. First, I want to introduce a cold message by Mr. Suzuki on a cassette there. Please.
Though we're beset by problems, in my travels around the world with the nature of things, I found many reasons to continue to hope. As people realize how little we know and how little we really control, they are turning to solutions that begin closer to home. As a biologist, I tend to think in terms of evolutionary time. In this century, we've undergone vast transformations, changes. We've changed from agrarian animals, from farmers, into city dwellers. We've changed from a very primitive kind of technological society into a very high-tech world. We've changed from very local methods of communication and transportation into global networks and global economies. And that has changed our impact as a species on the Earth. We've never had to worry about that in the past. I don't believe that people deliberately set out to defile or despoil our surroundings. Nobody is that evil or that short-sighted. But what we are doing collectively now, as a species, is having a major global impact. Now, how do we deal with that? How can we find solutions to it? I don't believe that there are organizations or that there should be organizations that will find solutions for the entire planet. The great key to survival of life on Earth, as well as our own survival, is diversity. The diverse species, the diverse genes, the diverse ecosystems, the diverse human communities and cultures have been the key to survival over time. And I believe in the long run, our way of finding ways to live in balance with our surroundings will come from diverse solutions in local economies and communities all over the world. Collectively, then, we become a radically different species, and one that can live in harmony with its surroundings.
My friends, what you just saw is an excerpt of one of the last TV shows, The Nature of Things, titled Race for the Future. The one you just heard is Dr. David Suzuki, the respected geneticist at the University of British Columbia, who for the last 21 years addressed, as the host of this show on CBC, issues on science, medicine, wildlife, technology, and environment in such a simple but brilliant, easily understood way that The Nature of Things now reaches millions of people in 60 nations of the world, from Canada to Zambia, to Australia and China. David Suzuki was also the producer of the PBS series, The Secret of Life, Discovery Channel's The Brain, and A Planet for the Taking, which won an award from the United Nations. From the geneticist to science popularizer, David Suzuki admits that he moved to work on environmental issues after Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. He was so transformed by the book, says he, that he became an eco-activist, a first on national TV, and took stands that often shocked the industrial sector. DDT, CFCs, GMOs, For David Suzuki, the dilemma has been and still is, how do we deal with human inventiveness and consumptive demand when we lack the knowledge base to manage our impact? This is a question all of us understand. This is the answer Dr. David Suzuki will elaborate for us, my friends. Dr. David Suzuki.
Je suis Canadien aussi, il faut parler français. Mais j'habite Vancouver et nous ne parlons pas beaucoup de français. Alors, je parlerai en anglais. I'm absolutely honored and I'm delighted to be here this evening. And I must say, when I came a few minutes early, I was totally freaked out because the place was empty. I didn't know you were all in there swilling booze, so... Thank you very much for taking time out from your evening to come in. As a scientist, I've been well aware now for almost 40 years that the most powerful force that's now shaping our lives and society today is science. Science, when applied by industry, medicine, and the military. As a parent, I also know that the ecological degradation we see going on around the world represents a fundamental challenge that is diminishing the options for our children and grandchildren. As a journalist, I know that you represent that very critical interface that allows or that is responsible for translating much of what's going on in ecology, in science, to the general public. And it's for that reason, the critical role that you play, that I feel so honored to be here tonight to address you. Now, when I was contacted, they didn't tell me what they wanted me to talk about. At least I didn't get any impressions, which gave me total freedom. Now, I'm not going to say anything that's worth anything for writing a story. So what I would like you to do is just sit back. You don't have to work tonight. Just sit back. And I'm just going to have a little self-indulgent evening myself and tell you a bit about how I got to where I am. My grandparents emigrated to Canada shortly after the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s. My parents were both born in Vancouver, my dad in 1909, my mother in 1911, in Vancouver. I too was born in Vancouver in 1936, so I represented the third generation then in Vancouver. In 1941, my family and 22,000 other Japanese Canadians were declared enemy aliens. Due to the iniquitous War Measures Act, which was imposed in early 1942, all of our rights as Canadian citizens were suspended, all of our property and possessions were confiscated, and we were incarcerated deep in the Rocky Mountains for 3 years. Our crime was the possession of genes, or the sharing of genes, with the enemy. They, in our case, had come from Japan three generations before. As the war drew to an end, something most Canadians don't realize, the British Columbia government saw a way of getting rid of at least part of it, the yellow peril problem. At least they could get rid of the Japs. And they did it by saying, we don't want any more left in this province. And they gave us the option of renouncing our Canadian citizenship, and we'd get a one-way ticket to Japan, or we had to go east of the Rockies and get out of the province. Something a lot of people don't know is over 95% of the people in those camps, even though the vast majority of them were Canadian citizens, were so pissed off at the government they signed to go to Japan. In our family's case, Japan was a foreign country, and we decided to stay. So we were among the first people shipped from British Columbia, and we ended up in Ontario, southern Ontario. Pearl Harbor and our incarceration and ultimate expulsion from British Columbia, those were the major forces that shaped my personality, my hang-ups, my demons, and my drives. I have a very warped need to succeed, not for fame or fortune, but to prove to my fellow Canadians that I'm a worthwhile person. I have a knee-jerk aversion to bigotry and discrimination, and I have hated to look in the mirror at my slitty eyes, which remind me of all of the wartime propaganda. When we ended up in Ontario, of course, we were destitute. And the one key that my parents felt for us to escape our poverty was hard work and education. Fortunately, I did well in school. And thanks to the great endowment at a college called Amherst College, I received a large scholarship to go down to Amherst College and receive an education that essentially molded me intellectually. As a biology honor, I had registered as a pre-med, as half my class registered as pre-med. But in my junior year, because I was a biology honor student, I had to take genetics. And I fell madly, madly in love with genetics. And from that point on, there was no turning back. I was accepted to medical school at the University of Western Ontario. I turned it down to go on for a PhD in genetics. Eventually, I was certified as an authentic geneticist at the University of Chicago and got my degree, I'm proud to say, from the Nobel laureate George Beadle in 1961. While I was in my junior year in 1957, I was electrified. I remember I was in the infirmary. I had come down with Asian or Hong Kong flu. I remember staggering into the infirmary and all these poor guys were just so sick and they booed and hissed when I walked in. So I was lying in bed sick as a dog and I had the radio on and I was electrified to hear that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik. And I don't think there's anyone here as old as I am, but some of you may remember those agonizing months that followed Sputnik as the Americans attempted over and over again to duplicate it and failed with spectacular fashion, right in full TV. As the Soviets scored one first after another, the first animal, Laika, in space, the first human in space, the first team of humans, the first woman in space. And we began to realize that there was a Soviet juggernaut that was incredibly advanced in medicine, in engineering, in mathematics, and in science. And so in the years following the shock of Sputnik, the United States began to pour billions of dollars into science education and set up NASA and began to play this incredible role of catching up. And just hearing the announcements this month of all of the Nobel Prizes, you just realize Americans now own the Nobel Prizes. I mean, the enormous impact of Sputnik or the post-Sputnik years is just seen in the long list of American scientists now that are just pulling down Nobel Prizes. And even though I was a Canadian going to school in the United States, I was a beneficiary of all of that excitement and the channeling of money into science. In all of that post-Sputnik time, I was taught by my professors that science is the most powerful way of knowing, that through science we push back the curtains of ignorance and reveal the deepest secrets of the cosmos. Through science we come to understand how nature works and we acquire the knowledge to manage the world around. And life for all people then, through the application of this knowledge, would get better and better. That's what I believed, and that's what I taught my students when I became a professor. I went down to the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee in the biology division on a postdoctoral fellowship. And for the first time, I encountered absolute naked racism in segregation, even in a border state like Tennessee. I identified completely with the black people. I was the only non-black person in the NAACP in Oak Ridge. And even though Canada had incarcerated us and treated us so badly, and I nevertheless decided I couldn't stand to live in the United States any longer. I wanted to go back to a country that was smaller, where I felt there was a chance for an individual to make a difference. So I took the first job I could get at the University of Alberta. First class that I taught was to a group of ag students. And man, I was pissed off about that. It was the best class I ever had. Those guys worked hard and they played hard. They were great. But they were Aggies, and they asked me questions about plant and animal breeding that I hadn't been taught. I was a hotshot geneticist. I wasn't interested in all that applied stuff. And because of the Aggies, I had to bone up on a lot of the plant and animal work that had gone on. It was too cold in Edmonton. The first winter I was there, it was 40 below for a month, so I took the first job I could get out of there and ended up back in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia in 63. And there, in my early classes, at least half the class were pre-meds. And of course, the pre-meds were asking questions about cloning and about eugenics and about genetic engineering. Again, stuff I didn't know anything about. And because of my students, I had to begin to do a lot of reading. And to my horror, I discovered a whole history of genetics that hadn't been taught to me, even though I had gone to a top-notch undergraduate liberal arts college. I'd gone to a top-notch graduate school in Chicago. None of this was a part of our education. I discovered that early in the 20th century, the exuberance over the discovery of genetic principles led geneticists to make all kinds of grand claims that they had their hands on the levers of life, that they had the potential to improve the human genetic makeup, that they were going to explain the heredity of things like syphilis and tuberculosis and criminality and drunkenness and indolence. These were the claims that were beginning to roll out of not just fly-by-night scientists, but top-notch geneticists. They set up a whole new area of science called eugenics, the improvement of the human genetic makeup. There was negative eugenics, which is to discourage people who were considered undesirable from having kids. And there was positive eugenics to encourage the kind that we want to improve the human genome with. And surprise, surprise, the people they wanted to encourage tended to be white, upper middle class individuals. But anyway, eugenics was legitimized. It was taught as a course in universities. There were eugenics journals. There was a eugenics society. There were eugenics fairs held all across North America. H.J. Muller, the Nobel laureate, was a leading advocate of this kind of eugenics policy. Edward East, professor at Harvard, president of the Genetic Society of America, wrote in his eugenics textbook, and I quote, "In reality, the Negro is inferior to the white. This is not conjecture or supposition, but a crude statement of scientific fact." Now, it's astonishing to me that anyone could use a word like inferior or superior and think that this was something that could be scientifically verified. This is a value judgment that's got nothing to do with science. But it was very easy for geneticists to confuse their own beliefs and values as something that was being validated by their own discipline. It was the result of these great claims of geneticists in the 1920s and 30s that led in the United States several states to pass anti-miscegenation laws, prevented interracial marriage, because it was thought that this led to disharmonious combinations when you combine these two different genomes together. It led to American restrictions on immigration from certain countries judged to have inferior genetic stock. And it led to eugenics acts, which allowed sterilization of inmates in mental institutions on a genetic basis. And in Canada, both British Columbia and Alberta enforced eugenics acts right up until in BC, the late 60s, in Alberta until the early 70s. And we're in Alberta still realizing the repercussion in a number of legal suits now from people that were sterilized under the Eugenics Acts. But the ultimate horror for me was the recognition that my incarceration as a Japanese Canadian had in many ways resulted from the grand claims of geneticists. It was the claims of geneticists about these outlandish things that they claimed were hereditary of human behavior that led people to assume that such traits as treachery that were indicated at Pearl Harbor, the sneak attack, were hereditary or characteristics of racial groups. If you read the record of the of Parliament in Ottawa, one of our members from BC, Mr. Neal, said at one point in 1939, "We in British Columbia are convinced once a Jap, always a Jap." In other words, it's hereditary, man. It doesn't matter whether they're born in this country or not. They're going to be the same, treacherous. And he said in 1941, "We in British Columbia are convinced that 9 times out of 10, intermarriage between whites and yellow people results in a mongrel wastrel." Well, it isn't exactly a 3-to-1 Mendelian ratio, but he actually tried to put a value on it. He said 9 times out of 10. I don't think that this is just kind of the loony ranting of a bigot. I think that this kind of statement of a member of parliament comes because it is legitimated by the kinds of claims that were being made by geneticists. To my horror, I realized that the Nazi race purification acts in Germany, which was one of the leading countries in genetics, had been predicated very firmly on the science of genetics. That Joseph Mengele, the infamous doctor of death at Auschwitz, held two peer-reviewed grants to do his studies on twins. I realized that, you know, one of the entrancing qualities of scientists is the ability of a scientist to get carried away with an idea, to get enthusiastic about it, and then begin to extrapolate what the potential applications of those things might be. But as Phil Abelson said in The Editor of Science way back in the 60s, geneticists will have high ideals for the application of their insights. In reality, as was the case with nuclear energy, power to apply those ideas will come to rest in other hands. That was a very prescient editorial that Abelson wrote in the 60s. For me, this was a grotesque intersection of the two great passions of my life as I began to realize the history of genetics. Genetics, which had become my profession and was my obsession, intersected then in this grotesque way with the other passion, civil rights. And I came to feel that the best way to avoid the abuse, the misuse of scientific knowledge is to rest a lot of the responsibility for application in the public, that the public had a vital role to play in how science ultimately would be applied, and therefore the vulgarization of science, the popularization of science, becomes an absolutely crucial area of activity. When I returned to Canada in 1962 from Oak Ridge, I was shocked to receive my first research grant for $4,200. And I was told that I got a bigger grant than normal because I'd had a year of postdoc, that normally a new assistant professor got a $3,500 grant. I would have gone back to the United States for sure, except that the Americans gave me a very large grant which they allowed me to keep in Canada. And thanks to you, I remained in my home country. But when I was offered in 1962 a chance to appear on a television program, I jumped at it because I thought I could do two things. I could perform my role as a scientist in popularizing science, explaining how genetics impinges on society, but I might also explain why science is important and why the public should support it more, and ultimately I'd get a bigger grant. So it was a very self-interested thing that I went into it. And as Jacques said, I was completely sidetracked from that by a woman. That woman I never met. The great regret of my life is that I never met Rachel Carson. But she had as great an impact on my life as any woman that I've ever known. Because when I read Silent Spring, it changed the way that I looked at the world as a scientist. I remind you that in Silent Spring, she pointed out that we are a very clever animal. We can invent very powerful technologies, in her case, pesticides. But because our knowledge of how the world works is so limited, we can't anticipate what the consequences will be. And if we think that we're not a part of the natural world that we're assaulting with our technology, we delude ourselves if we think it won't ultimately come back and affect us as well. So I, like millions of people around the world, was swept up in that first green wave of environmentalism. In British Columbia, we were fighting issues of American blasts in Amchitka, which led to the formation of Greenpeace. We were fighting against clear-cut logging in the province, against pulp mill pollution and tailings from mines. We were fighting against dams, major dams in our rivers. In my mind, the problem was very simple. Human beings were taking too much stuff out of the environment, and we were putting too much toxic garbage back into it. So in my simple way of thinking, the solution is you've got to legislate how much and what humans are allowed to take out of the environment and how much and what we're allowed to put back into it, and then you set up the infrastructure to enforce your legislation. So in addition to protesting against forest companies and mining companies, we were lobbying like mad in Ottawa, trying to get governments to enact Clean Air Acts and Clean Water and Endangered Species Acts, and to set up the agencies to enforce those acts. But by the late 60s, for me, having read Rachel Carson and all that stuff, it became very obvious that this can't possibly work. Because, as Carson said, we don't know enough to know how our technology will impinge. I want to remind you, when DDT was first synthesized in the 1800s, I think it was 1890-something, by a German scientist. But in the late 30s, it was a Swiss scientist working for Geigy that found that it was a very powerful insecticide. That was considered such an important discovery that he won a Nobel Prize in 1948. And I remember vividly in the late 40s, we were living on a farm in southern Ontario, and my mother would set the dinner table, and then she would take a spray can and spray DDT over the top of the table, and it would settle down in our food. In the show that where Jacques took the clip, The Race for the Future, we have shots of children in the 1950s where their schoolyard has been fogged with DDT, and they're playing hide-and-go-seek in the cloud of DDT that's still hanging over the schoolyard, because we believed what we were told. This was a miracle chemical. It killed bugs, but it didn't do anything to people. And as you all know, it was only when bird watchers began to realize that certain birds, raptors, were disappearing, that biologists tracked it down and discovered biomagnification. That biomagnification, even though we spray DDT at concentrations of parts per million, at each trophic level up the food chain, we amplify the concentration. So by the time you get to the fatty tissue of women's breasts or the shell glands of birds, you've concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. How could we regulate DDT at the time that it began to be used when we didn't even know the phenomenon of biomagnification until eagles began to disappear? CFCs. CFCs, when they were synthesized, again, hailed as miracle chemicals, completely inert chemically, perfect for being carriers in aerosol cans. Put your underarm deodorant in there and it doesn't react at all with the CFCs. But it was only after millions of tons of CFCs had been manufactured and used that scientists discovered in the upper atmosphere, well, you all know this stuff, ultraviolet breaks chlorine-free radicals off CFCs, and chlorine-free radicals are potent scavengers of ozone. How could we regulate CFCs when we had no idea of the ultimate fate of CFCs in the atmosphere? And mark my words, GMOs will prove to be exactly the same. Genetic engineering, biotechnology, is a revolutionary technology. And we are doing things now that are absolutely mind-boggling. It's exciting. It's thrilling. You know, we're going to have the entire genome, human genome, sequenced very, very soon. That's an amazing achievement, something I never thought I would live to see in my lifetime. But the very fact that it's revolutionary means what? It means that most of our current ideas about what we're doing are going to be wrong, for one thing. When I tell kids today what we thought were the hottest ideas in 1961, they fall on the floor laughing. Because in the year 2000, what were the best ideas in 61 seem absurd, and they are. But that's the nature of science. 20 years from now, our current hot ideas are going to seem so crude and so far off the mark, they will laugh at us. So the question is, why are we anxious to rush this stuff out into the field? Why are we anxious to throw it down the throats of North Americans? Europeans, who are demanding labeling of GMOs in their food, are saying, look, if you want to find out whether it's dangerous to people, just watch the Canadians. They've been doing the experiment for us for 4 years. We've been eating GMOs in our food for 4 years, and we haven't even known about it. But when you take a revolutionary technology, there are going to be effects in the real world that scientists simply cannot anticipate. For me, the difficulty then was, if we invent very powerful technologies, but if our knowledge base is so limited, how in the heck can we ever manage the way that we use these technologies? We have these people all over society. I'm sure many of you interview them all the time. These are experts in water management, experts in silviculture, experts in salmon enhancement, experts in halibut management, and we have experts of all kinds. Well, when you talk about managing anything, let's take something far simpler than the natural world. Let's take someone who wants to manage a candy factory. What do you need to manage a candy factory forever, or as far in the future as you can imagine? I would think you need at least two things. You need an inventory of everything in your candy factory, and you need a blueprint showing how everything in your inventory is interconnected. And once you have that, maybe you could manage your factory indefinitely. Well, we have all these managers of nature. How well can we manage nature? What is our inventory? How many species are there? As you know, we have no idea. You know, there are all kinds of ways of making estimates, and as near as I can gather, the estimates now that most people agree on, I've seen estimates from 2 million to 10 million, 100 million, but people seem to be coming down around 10 to 15 million species. How many do we know? 1.4 million, according to Ed Wilson. That's 1.4 million species that have been given a name. Someone sitting in a lab has had a dead specimen and given it a name. Doesn't mean we have any idea where do they live, how many are there, what do they eat, how do they reproduce, how do they interact with other species. It's just someone has given a dead specimen a name. When it comes to knowing anything about the basic biology of species, Ed Wilson says we probably know a fraction of a fraction of 1% of all that we have identified so far. So if our knowledge base is that restricted, how can anyone claim that we know how to manage any natural system? People who talk about managing forests, clear-cutting a forest and planting what they call a natural forest, which is a plantation, not a forest. I mean, they're not even talking about a forest when they talk about reforestation. For me, this was a real crisis in my life because I realized as a scientist, we were contributing to very powerful technologies, but we didn't have a real clue as to how to manage the impact in the real world. And it was in the late 70s for me that a real change happened. We decided at the Nature of Things to do a film on the fight over clear-cut logging in the archipelago that comes off the Alaskan Panhandle. It's the westernmost archipelago in Canada, called the Queen Charlotte Islands. The Haida people who've lived there for 12,000 years call this Haida Gwaii, the home of the Haida people. And there had been this battle going on with McMillan Bloedel for many years. And I flew into Charlotte City and interviewed a number of people on all sides of the issue. And one of the people I interviewed was a young Haida artist named Gujau, who is now not a young Haida artist anymore. He's the president of the Haida Nation. But back then, he had been fighting against logging for many years. And I said to him, listen, Gujau, you've got over 80% unemployment in Masset and Skidigat, your two communities. A lot of the loggers are Haida. So logging is giving your people work. When McMillan Bloedel workers come in to log, they shop in your stores, they use your barber shops, they shop in your bakeries. Isn't that good for your community? McMillan Bloedel is bringing economic progress into your community. And his answer was very simple. He said, sure, they can cut all those trees down and we'll still be around. But once they do that, he said, we won't be Haida anymore. We'll just be like everybody else. And when he said that to me at the time, I was busy trying to get what I wanted out of him. I didn't really think about it very much, and I certainly didn't understand it. And it was only when I went back home and thought about what he'd said, I realized that he had given me a glimpse of a fundamentally different way of looking at the world. To the Haida, they don't end at their fingertips or their skin. To the Haida, being Haida means being connected to the land in a fundamentally different way from the way we feel. My grandparents came from Japan to Canada. They had no intention of living in Canada. All they saw was opportunity. They saw resources. They saw commodities. They saw wealth. They wanted to get their wealth and get out of there and go back to civilization. Fortunately, two of their kids were my mom and dad, who said, we don't want to go to that foreign country. We're Canadians. But that's the kind of value system that is embodied in most of us who have come to North America in the last 500 years. But what the Haida were telling us is that the land embodies their history, their culture. The very reason why Haida are on this earth is told to them by the land. And when you break that connection, then they can be poor trash like anybody else. They no longer are special or different. And ever since then, I've been fortunate to have traveled to many parts of the world. I've been to Madagascar, to the Serengeti, to the Kalahari, to Papua New Guinea and Borneo and Australia and New Zealand. And everywhere I've sought out indigenous people, and it's always the same. Often they're incredibly impoverished, they're communities that are dysfunctional, they have violence, suicide, alcoholism, and yet there is something fundamentally different in their sense of connection with the land. They refer to the earth as their mother, and they say that we are born made up of the four sacred elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And as I reflected on that, I realized we have framed the whole environmental issue the wrong way. There is no environment out there, and we are here. And we have to manage the way we interact with the environment. We are the environment. I mean, the First Nations are right. We are the earth. We're born of the earth, and we're made of the four sacred elements. Now, I'm not speaking metaphorically or poetically. I mean this in the most scientifically profound way. When a baby leaves a mother's body, what is the absolutely first thing that baby needs? Needs a breath of air. And from that point on, 15 to 30 times a minute, until its last gasp on its deathbed, that child will need air. And we don't even think about it. What happens to air when we breathe? We take it deep into the most intimate, warm, moist parts of our bodies, and we fuse to it. I mean, it rushes into our lungs, which are filled with 300 million alveoli. The alveoli are lined with a three-layered membrane called a cerebellum. Could you stop now? I'm sorry, could you wait till I'm finished? There's a three-layered membrane lining each alveolus called a surfactant that reduces surface tension. So when the air rushes into the lungs, hits the surfactant and instantly sticks to the surface. Carbon dioxide rushes out, oxygen rushes in, and then we exhale. And when we exhale, you don't breathe everything out, because if you did that, your lungs would collapse. About half of the air that's in your lungs stays in your lungs. The point is, you can't draw a line that says the air ends here and we begin there. We literally are the air. It's stuck to us and it's always in us. And whatever comes out of our nose, of course, goes right up everybody else's nose. So, you know, air isn't a vacuum or an empty space. It's a physical substance that connects us, that embeds us in it. We are a single layer of life held together by a matrix of air. That air connects not only all of us, it connects all of the trees and the birds and the worms and the spiders. We're all held together by this sacred substance of air. And I remind you of this wonderful thought exercise that Harlow Shapley, the American astronomer, did many, many years ago. He wanted to follow a single breath of air. I don't know how many. Have you all heard this? It's an amazing exercise, because how do you follow a breath of air that comes out of your body? 99% of the air is oxygen and nitrogen. And we need the air because for the oxygen, of course. So you breathe the air in, and a lot of that oxygen never gets out again because we're using it in our metabolic fires. Some of the nitrogen comes in and reacts biochemically as well. But 1% of the air is argon. And argon, you know, is an inert gas. It doesn't react with anything. You breathe it in, it goes into your body, you breathe it right out, it comes out again. So argon is a very nice marker for a breath of air. So Shapley calculates how many atoms of argon are there in a breath of air. 3 times 10 to the 19th. 3 followed by 19 zeros. Well, that's a lot of argon. So you follow a breath that comes out of your nose or my nose, it very quickly mixes in the room, and what was in your body very quickly is shared with everybody in the room. The door is open, out it goes across Michigan, across the United States, around the world. And according to Shapley, a year later, if you came back into this room, every breath you take would have 15 argon atoms at least that were in that one breath a year before. So calculating this way, he calculates every breath we take today has at least 400,000 argon atoms that were in the body of Mahatma Gandhi. That every breath we take has hundreds of thousands of argon atoms that were in Joan of Arc and Jesus Christ. That every breath we take has argon atoms that were in dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And every breath we take will suffuse life into the future as far as we can see. So not only is air this wonderful matrix that holds us together, it connects us in one continuous web to the past, through the present, and into the future. So air, I really think, deserves to be called this sacred element. We boast that we are an intelligent creature. We're smart. But what intelligent creature, knowing the role that air plays, would then proceed to use air as a toxic dump, as if somehow it's going to go out there and diffuse away and we don't have to worry about it? We have a tradition of coal mining in Nova Scotia. And miners in Nova Scotia used to take canaries down there. When the canary keeled over, they didn't say, "Hey, Jack, the bird just fell over. What do you think? Do you think it's dangerous? I mean, maybe we better check." They hauled their asses out of there as fast as they could go. The reason they took the canaries down was they're super sensitive, right? They gave them a bit of early warning. Today, canaries are falling all over the place, and where are we paying attention? We see the canaries falling in the Inuit in the north in terms of global warming. We see them there, and they're telling us that all kinds of changes are happening that are undeniable. They're seeing herring and salmon in the Arctic where they've never been before. They're seeing barn swallows and robins where they've never been. Children freak out because they've never seen dragonflies in their lives, but they are now because insects are moving up. The question is, what is it going to take then when the canaries start falling? If we don't pay attention to plants and animals, what about us? 16,000 Canadians die every year as a result of air pollution. We don't pay attention to that. We still are pumping out stuff from our coal-burning energy plants. Well, our children have actually become the canaries in the coal mine. Today, every child born has a 1 in 5 chance of developing asthma. I grew up as a boy in the 40s. I had never heard the word asthma. The first person I ever met with asthma was in college, and I thought it was kind of a wimpy disease because he didn't take PE. Until I did a film on asthma, and I was horrified to see a child in full-blown asthma attack. And that child is suffocating right in front of your eyes. And it astonishes me that our children have become the canaries in the coal mine, and we still are not responding to it. What do we think? That better puffers and better chemicals like Ventolin are the answer? If you dump it into the air, we are air, and we're dumping it into ourselves. Water, we are water. I mean, that's obvious. 60% water in most of us by weight is water. I mean, we're just a blob of water with enough organic thickener added so we don't dribble away on the floor. The deal is, of course, that where our bodies are leaking water all the time. It's coming out of my skin and my eyes and mouth and crotch and everywhere it's coming up. And the amazing thing to me is our bodies know that. I mean, we don't have to worry about whether we're topped up right. I mean, if you drank, we're constantly having to eat and drink as much water as we lose. If you drank 1 milliliter of water more a day than you lose, in a few weeks you'd blow up. Or if you drank 1 milliliter of water less a day than you lose, you'd shrivel away. But we don't, because our bodies regulate our intake very carefully, and our body content of water stays very nicely constant. When you take a drink of water to top up, where do you think that water comes from? Is this Lansing water that we're drinking here? I mean, the first science lesson I remember from elementary school was a water cycle. Remember the hydrologic cycle? Water covers 71% of the earth, evaporates, forms clouds, rains on the land, runs in the rivers and lakes, evaporates. Water cartwheels around the earth. So every glass you drink, doesn't matter where you are, has gazillions of water molecules that have come from all the oceans of the world, evaporated off the canopy of the Choco rainforest in Colombia, of the steppes of Russia and the grasslands of Canada. Water is like air. It's a glue that connects us together. We say we're intelligent. We use water as a toxic dump. What we do to the water, we do to ourselves, because we are water. We're the earth. And something that always amazes me when I talk to children, when I tell them that every bit of their food was once living, they're just shocked. You mean it's not, milk isn't made in a chemical factory? Every bit of our food was once alive. It's the most intimate relationship, as Martha Crouch says, with another being. We take it into our mouth and we actually incorporate that being into our bodies. So I tell children we're just a compost heap for the carcasses of plants and animals that we eat for our nutrition. And where does that come from? 98% of our food comes from the soil. We are the earth in the most profound way, because what we eat are soil beings that grow in the earth. We say we're intelligent and we use the soil as a toxic dump. Fire, we are fire. What made life on this planet possible was energy. Every bit of the energy in our bodies we need to move and grow and reproduce is sunlight. Sunlight captured by plants and stored so that we could exploit that stored chemical energy. When plants discovered a way to eat sunlight and transform that energy into chemical, into sugar, then all of the other life forms could exploit that. We could eat plants or eat animals that eat plants and derive that energy. And every bit of the energy that we burn today, from peat to wood to coal, oil and gas, all of that is sunlight, captured by photosynthesis and stored ultimately in the earth. So what First Nations, Aboriginal people around the world tell us is absolutely true in the most profound way, and shapes then, it seems to me, that the way that we have to deal with this environmental crisis. It's a human crisis. What we do to the earth, we do directly to ourselves. And it seems to me that frames the problems in a fundamentally different way. Air, water, soil, clean energy, those are sacred. And the way that they should be the foundation of the way that we live. We should protect and savor them. We should do all we can to protect their cleanliness and base the way we live on the principle of protecting those sacred elements. To me, I wrote about this in a book I did for my foundation called The Sacred Balance, and which I then wrote as a children's book called You Are the Earth. And as I wrote The Sacred Balance, I realized in a profound way. The most amazing miracle is that what delivers the four sacred elements to us so that we can use them is life itself. Biodiversity, or what the public calls nature, nature delivers earth, air, fire, and water to us. Now, what am I talking about? If we took a time capsule back 4 billion years before there was any life on Earth, and we opened the door and walked out, we'd be dead in a matter of minutes, as you all know, because the air was completely toxic. It was filled with carbon dioxide and there was no oxygen in it. It was only when plants invented photosynthesis and began to take carbon dioxide out of the air to form sugar molecules that they gave off this byproduct of oxygen and transformed the air from a reducing atmosphere to an oxidizing one over millions of years. And to this very day, all of the green things on the planet continue to perform that function of taking carbon dioxide out of the air and giving us oxygen back. In Vancouver, we have the best water in the world, I believe, because we get it from three watersheds that are surrounded by old growth rainforests. And those tree roots and the plants in the soil and the soil fungi and microorganisms filter the water so that we can drink it without fear. And I think that, again, that's a wonderful service that nature performs for us. Before there was any life on Earth, there was no soil to grow food, because soil is, by definition, created by the addition of organic molecules from life itself. So there was dust and clay and gravel and sand, but before life arose, there was no soil. So not only is all of our food from nature, but the very soil that we need to grow our domesticated crops are created by nature itself and continue to be. And of course, the best energy that we can possibly get continues to be clean and renewable energy that ultimately comes from the sun, and we can capture that through plants and exploit it in various ways. So again, I say that nature or biodiversity is the source of the four sacred elements. We say we're intelligent, and yet we are assaulting the web of living things in an unprecedented manner, in a manner that biologists now say is the sixth major extinction crisis. As we tear at the web of life, at biodiversity, then we put in much greater jeopardy the capacity of nature to deliver the four sacred elements for us. That, for me, is where I've come to as a geneticist who's transformed into a broadcaster and into an ecological activist, and I hope it's of some interest to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Suzuki. It was a really good summary of who we are. We don't know where we're heading, though. Thank you very much again.